Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. We are here on case 13-1973, State of Ohio v. Sudinia Johnson. For the appellant, Mr. Gallagher.
Good morning, Chief Justice O'Connor. May it please the court. The United States Supreme Court has over and over again emphasized the mandate of the Fourth Amendment, which is that searches conducted outside the judicial process are per se unreasonable. And that's what has occurred in this case. The exclusionary evidence rule is a doctrine which compels respect for the constitutional guarantees of the Fourth Amendment and deters future Fourth Amendment violations. And that is what every Supreme Court case that has dealt with the exclusionary rule in creating good faith exceptions has had to deal with, which is the deterrence of future Fourth Amendment violations.
Counsel, does it make any difference, or should it, in terms of how we decide this issue, that the GPS was applied on a public street as opposed to being applied to a vehicle on private property?
I don't believe so, because United States versus Jones has already decided, I think, for this court, which is the application of the device itself to a car. It doesn't matter where that car was, but the fact that the car was the private property that the device was attached to. So now the question becomes, with Jones, there clearly is a Fourth Amendment violation. In this case, Mr. Johnson, it's already been determined that there was, in fact, a Fourth Amendment violation. The default, the requirement from the United States Supreme Court, then, is to apply the exclusionary rule, unless, of course, there is a good faith exception. There is not a recognized good faith exception in this case. The closest that you have is United States versus Davis. But Davis makes it very, very clear and very, very specific in all the conversation throughout Davis what is necessary in order to invoke that exception to the exclusionary rule. You need a specific binding appellate court case that is unequivocal, specific, binding and unequivocal. That does not exist here. There is no case in the state of Ohio, there was no case from the United States Supreme Court that sanctioned what Officer Hackney did in this case. In the absence of that, the exclusionary rule requires that the evidence in this case be suppressed.
When you said that there was nothing that sanctioned it, there was nothing that prohibited it either, correct? There was no legal case that talked about a GPS on a car.
Absolutely, and that is why it's a violation of the Fourth Amendment. There was absolutely nothing that permitted an officer to avoid going to see a judge and asking permission to do so. He did that on his own without legal justification for doing so.
The word search, though, search and seizure under the Fourth Amendment, Would you agree that placing an item on a car, as was done here, and specifically tell us where the item was placed underneath the carriage?
It was the undercarriage of the car.
Okay.
Was the testimony.
So would you agree that ordinarily that would not be considered a search or a seizure, as those words are typically used? Going into a home or patting someone down, we're talking about the usual terms of search and seizure. Placing an item on the undercarriage of a car, and as Justice Pfeiffer said, on an open road, that is not within the normal thinking of what search and seizure means. Would you agree?
I would not, and I think Justice Scalia wouldn't agree, because Justice Scalia went back and said, even back in 1787, what happened here would have been a search. And he made the analogy to that and support for that, that for over 200 years, what happened here clearly was a search, and that was a holding in Jones. And you also had before that United States versus Kylo, which was the infrared, and that predates this action here.
We're also talking about good faith of the officer, what
Absolutely.
An officer would believe in terms of what the officer should be doing to protect Fourth Amendment rights, correct?
Correct, but in order for that exception to apply, it has to have been recognized by the United States Supreme Court. To date, there has been nothing close to that says that an officer can rely on some sort of general practice or some other lower court or some other court somewhere else to find justification when in his own jurisdiction or with the United States Supreme Court, he can find no support for what he wants to do. Because what we want officers, and every holding is always said, what we want officers to do is default, go to a judge and ask for permission to search before doing so. That's what we're trying to get in every case.
Was there a conversation between the officer and the prosecuting attorney in this case before the GPS was attached to this vehicle?
Not in this case and not pertaining to this case. What the testimony was from Officer Hackney at the motion to suppress was some 2 years before the action in this case, he had a conversation with a prosecutor where he asked whether or not he needed to get a warrant. He said that he also had
sought legal advice from.
He sought some legal advice, absolutely. All right. That's clear.
How do you see the interplay of the case from the United States Supreme Court in Knotts, where the Supreme Court authorized the placement of a beeper,
yes, sir,
inside a container, and the Supreme Court said that would be acceptable conduct,
correct,
as analogous to this case?
It clearly was somehow analogous because we had the same discussion a couple years ago when we were first addressing the Jones case about whether or not analogies can be made and whether or not they should be made. Knotts was not overruled by United States versus Jones. Specifically said they didn't have to go to that rationale. And we are talking about different technology. And what occurred in Knotts was, and there was that caveat in Knotts that said, if technology changes and we get to a different situation, we're going to have to revisit this. That was the first indication to any law enforcement or prosecutor of, you can't rely on Knotts because Knotts told you this may not apply to new technology. You then went to Caro, another beeper case that said, you now have trespass issues and going on to private property issues. Be forewarned, you may not be able to rely on Caro or
Knotts. But that was a private property case.
Absolutely, but that
was
one.
And this isn't a private property situation.
But the beeper may go on to, and what happened in Caro was not the placement on private property, it's where that beeper went that Caro had some problems with. And all I'm saying is that if you're going to try and rely on those in order to establish good faith, you had warnings that you may not be treading on very, very solid ground, that you have some issues, and the technology has changed, which was not warned you about.
So, counsel, are you going to attribute that type of a sophisticated legal knowledge to this officer and say, therefore, there is no good faith? Because the officer and the advice that they sought was pre-Jones, correct?
Correct.
All right. So the Supreme Court had not spoken on whether or not you could put a tracking device on the undercarriage of a vehicle.
A GPS tracking device, you're correct.
Okay. So the best authority that the officer had to rely on, or the assistant prosecutor, whomever he spoke with several years even prior to that, would have been Knotts, correct?
Could have been Knotts, Caro, and Kylo. Those three cases talk about the
and they say, yeah, it's okay to do this, it's okay to do this.
Well, not necessarily, because what Knotts said was, the beeper, yes, but if technology changes, we're going to have to revisit this.
If technology changes, but there was no definition of what that technology change would have to be in order for Knotts not to be
correct.
Good law.
Correct.
And this vehicle traveled on open roads, correct?
Some of the indications are clearly was on an open road.
Open
yes,
road.
Sir.
So
yes.
That kind of takes it out of the arena of Caro, does it not?
Not necessarily, because it also went on the private property, and that was one of the concerns of Caro, was the monitoring on the private property.
Well, at the destination, it got to private property.
Well, the question was the ability to monitor somebody when they have entered onto private property. That was a major concern in Caro, and that's one of the things that occurred in this case. Was
they didn't really need that monitoring when they ended up on the private property. That wasn't part of the big
right,
picture.
But the officers didn't know that at the time that the placement was on. And that was one of the reasons why I don't think that good faith applies in this case, because there were enough warnings to an officer or anyone else. What they could look to is a practice that existed in Columbus and almost all over throughout the United States through U.S. Attorney's Office and federal agents, which was the application for warrants for GPS devices, recognizing that they didn't think they needed so. They were making Rule 41 applications for GPS tracking devices with the preamble of, we believe we do not need a warrant, but because it hasn't been decided on GPS tracking, we're asking for one. Because
counsel,
there were those warnings in Knotts and Caro and Kylo. We want that default. We want officers not to decide for themselves whether they need
a warrant. I guess, counsel, that's where I'm find myself getting a little confused here, because the good faith exception, as I understand it, is a police officer has a good faith belief that the warrant that he's executing is a valid warrant, and if it's later found out it's not, then he still had good faith.
Yes, sir.
What in the world can we say these officers had good faith expectation of? Had this court or any court actually found going up and putting a GPS on somebody's van is not an unreasonable search?
There were courts before Cedeno Johnson's that cut both ways. There was Garcia in the Seventh Circuit. There were state court cases out of Washington
and out of Oregon.
I
guess that's what I'm saying. I'm following the chief's question. I mean, these are police officers. I don't expect them to have a PhD in law enforcement. And what are they relying upon when they're under the van? What's their good faith?
Well, the belief that they don't need a warrant. I mean, they're going to say that they didn't think they needed a warrant because they asked the prosecutor and they had been to classes where it was generally discussed that you didn't need one.
And that's why we're here today.
We're here today because they didn't seek a warrant. They had time to seek a warrant but chose not to because they thought they were okay. And the good faith exceptions is recognized by the United States Supreme Court. In every single situation, it was someone else's act that led to the problems that they got into. It was a legislature that decided to give them a pass on administrative searches without a warrant. It was in Leon, a magistrate who signed a warrant that shouldn't have been signed. Or it was in Herring, which was in another county, a clerk forgot to pull a warrant out of the system before radioing it in. The officer conducting the search believed either there was a warrant in existence or had, as Davis said, binding appellate precedent and had no culpability. The culpability doesn't have to be evil. It has to be a deliberate act.
Counsel, if we can talk about the technology
for
a second. If we go back to Knotts that Justice O'Donnell was asking you about, in Knotts, the U.S. Supreme Court said it's okay to put a beeper on a car, and the purpose of the beeper was for tracking.
Correct.
Was it not?
Correct.
So how different is the technology then between the beeper that was at issue in Knotts and the GPS tracker that we have now?
Well, it seems enough so that it's alarmed a whole number of courts to cause concern about it in terms of the information it may collect. It's not much different than what you had to deal with in Ohio versus Smith, which was the idea of what a container was had changed because of the technology. What a phone was had changed over time, enough so that it required a different analysis and should have put everyone on notice about that this is a little bit different, and you applied a different Fourth Amendment. Knotts gave warning, though. It didn't just say monitoring is okay. It said this type of monitoring is okay, but we're not sure if we're okay with this sort of 24-hour dragnet, and we may have to revisit it.
But why was it okay? If you've got a beeper on your car that you don't know about,
correct?
And law enforcement is using it to track your location. Isn't that exactly what they were doing with the GPS? I understand that a GPS's technology is different and you would likely gather more information, but the purpose is still the same. I'm going to track your vehicle and find you eventually.
It may also be some of the information it's gathered, personal nature. There's a lot of things that
like
can be gathered
with
GPS. Well, the technology talked about exact locations. A beeper could never give exact locations. It could general locations. GPS can track speed. GPS can track a number of stops. GPS can track over a significant period of time and map out.
If a beeper, a laden car, is being followed by law enforcement, which is usually what the protocol was with a beeper.
Yes.
They know exactly where the car is going, even more accurately than someone relying on a laptop and a GPS system.
Well, all I can say is that for whatever the reasons, and we know the reasons why, United States versus Jones is now the law about GPS, that you can't do so without a warrant.
Well, right. And if Jones was on the books when your client was arrested for this illegal activity, we wouldn't be standing here.
But it isn't the technology, but the technology, at least the warning from Knotts, no matter what the technology is, if someone says, I relied on Knotts and I didn't have to worry about anything, there's two things that are of concern. One is the officer still went around and started to ask. So obviously it wasn't clear to him that Knotts told him that that was okay. And there's nothing in the record that said what the prosecutor knew when he gave this opinion that it was okay. But the warning in Knotts said you might be treading on very different ground if the technology changes. It doesn't say how, but it said if the technology changes. Kylo was another case where now we're not even physically going into someone's house. And Justice Scalia and Roberts had serious problems because of technology. Now we had another Fourth Amendment violation. What those do is they put on the police officer the warning to say, you know what, you might want to do what the U.S. Attorney's Office and the agents are doing, which is default to asking for a warrant, because that's what we're talking about.
Let me ask you about the scope of this case.
Yes, sir.
We know now because of Jones that if a law enforcement agency is desirous of tracking with a GPS, it's necessary to secure a warrant before it can be attached to a vehicle.
Yes, sir.
But we did not know that at the time that this action took place.
I would suggest otherwise, because there were a number of cases that began to suggest that.
I understand your argument, and I understand the cases that we've been over a couple of times. The question I have for you is, what is the breadth of the scope of the impact of today's decision? Are there a myriad of these cases out there pre-Jones that have warrants around, or are we now in such a narrow field that we're not going to see this kind of case anymore?
Well, I don't know if that's necessarily the case, because now we have the post sort of Riley cases as well.
What?
In the post Riley cases, which are cell phone cases, and every time technology changes, if officers are going and not using warrants, and they do so with the belief that another case said it was okay and they find out differently, you may. Because that's why Davis is so easy to apply in this case. If you apply Davis in its literal words, which is binding precedent allows good faith to apply. So in the absence of that, it doesn't.
But binding precedent allowed the tracking device of a beeper in a vehicle.
Correct. But the United States versus Jones has announced very, very clear that Knotts is not binding precedent.
Not now.
It wasn't at any point, because if it did, it would have had to have overruled Knotts in order to come to the conclusion that it did.
All right, so that was all done subsequent to this officer's knowledge.
Correct.
Of the actual situation and asking the prosecutor, so it has to be subsequent to the prosecutor's legal knowledge as well. Jones wasn't decided. The proclamation about Knox wasn't on the books, so to speak, for the prosecutor to take into consideration. So law enforcement at the time, and whether you want to argue, well, the feds would have done it this way or this jurisdiction would have done it that way, et cetera, the fact of the matter is, in this jurisdiction, it was okay to put a beeper in a vehicle and track it.
There was never a decision in the state of Ohio that authorized that. This was a case of first impression, Johnson was. Everyone admitted to that this was a case of first impression, that there was nothing in the state of Ohio that told that officer that it was okay. There was no decision that guided him.
Put a GPS system on.
Absolutely.
But I'm talking about Knox, and Knox said you can have a beeper in a vehicle.
Absolutely.
And that was good law in Ohio.
Absolutely. But that's not the binding precedent that Davis speaks of. It says specific and unequivocal. And we had this discussion 2 years ago about what applies and what doesn't, which was clear indication that this was not unequivocal. This was not specific and binding as Davis requires. There were other decisions.
There have been jurisdictions that have expanded on or loosened the standard for Davis.
Absolutely. And that's the question, I think, before this court, and what comes from that, and whether or not that is truly authorized by the United States Supreme Court, because the United States Supreme Court makes it relatively clear that it has to be binding, it has to be specific. Justice Sotomayor, and I understand it's at a concurrence, clearly says out loud that if we didn't have this, we might be looking at a completely different result. She doesn't say what that is, and it is not discussed by the majority. They don't discount that statement from Justice Sotomayor at all.
Thank you.
Obviously accept that, but they don't discount it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Counsel?
Chief Justice O'Connor, may it please the court. Michael Oster on behalf of the state. Your Honors, just procedurally, I'll be arguing for 10 minutes, and then my colleague from the Attorney General's office will take the remaining 5 minutes of the appellee's argument here today.
Counsel, I'm wondering, when we're asked to decide the good faith issue, should we, in balancing that out, analyze whether or not this officer could have gotten a warrant, or on the facts that he had a pretty good idea he couldn't get a warrant, and should that make a difference? You get what I'm saying? If he does this, going, look, I've got all this information, I could, easily get the judge, but I don't think I need to bother the judge because this is, you know, we've got all of this. But if he's not going to see the judge because he thinks the judge didn't go buy this and isn't going to grant the warrant, wouldn't that make a difference in our assessment of good faith? And can you relate the facts of this case to that question?
Yeah. Yes, Your Honor. I think if a hypothetical were taken to the extreme of what the question was, where a officer actually thought in his mind, or it was on the record somewhere, I didn't think a judge would sign this warrant, then I would say under that cost-benefit analysis that is the good faith exception, there you would have a deliberate or reckless or possibly grossly negligent act of an officer. Here, in this case now, to address it, we don't have anything even close to resembling that situation. The officers here had tips. They had knowledge of what was going on. They had done a trash pull already. And most importantly, when
did the trash pull yield anything?
I believe the trash pull revealed receipts detailing that the van was traveling between Ohio and Chicago, which was the route of travel again that we had in this case. So it did detail
that no drugs or drug paraphernalia or
no, but it corroborated the tip. The tip was that Mr. Johnson was trafficking in cocaine from Ohio to Chicago and back. So it did corroborate the tip that they had received.
Well, it corroborated about that the van was going back and forth from Ohio to Chicago.
Correct. It corroborated that. But in this case, when you're looking at what you would want an officer to do in this case, and I think it's important not only to Judge Nastoff make
these. Well, when we want an officer, I mean, it isn't that hard to talk judges into giving you search warrants. Wouldn't we want an officer, as a common practice, to do that, to say, you know, like,
as a common
practice, it's not midnight. There wasn't any urgency of time, as I recall, on the facts here, right?
I would disagree somewhat. I mean, after the tracker was placed, the trip to Chicago was within the next couple days. This tracker was only on for 5 days.
We're not talking about it's midnight, the judge is asleep, and we really don't want to go out and knock on his door at 2:00 in the morning.
No, but we are talking about an officer who had gone to specialized training on this issue, had talked to his supervisors, had talked to other drug task force members, had talked to a prosecuting attorney and said he believed it was also that attorney had talked to one other, who was able to detail to the court during this hearing on page 27 through 28, the motion to suppress hearing, that he knew the law was that he could not hardwire a GPS to the car because that meant that you needed a warrant. But he says it would be the exact same as if I went out and visually surveilled this car on public roads, in essence detailing the exact holding of what the Knotts case stood for. So you had an officer who checked with law enforcement, checked with a prosecutor who said he spoke with possibly one other, was able to detail the state of the law, and I think it's important what the appellant here didn't discuss at all.
There is testimony the officer knew he couldn't hardwire.
Correct. Which was
this GPS, and he grew up in law enforcement. In the 20 years earlier, the FBI was putting recording devices in the cars that the mob traveled around in these big cities. But they always got a warrant for that, didn't they?
I don't know the practices of the FBI 20 years before that. I'm sorry, I don't know if they did that or not. To answer your question, I'll assume that you're saying it is true.
But you're saying he had reasonable belief that Knotts said you do not need a warrant for what you're about to do.
Correct. And even more so, he had an understanding of what the current state of the law was throughout the country. And what the appellant here didn't discuss, but what's in the trial court's findings, is that throughout the country in 2008, I think it's important to remember, this was placed in October of 2008, you had the Garcia Court and the MacIver Court, two circuit courts in the United States, who said not only was beeper tracking okay, they said that a GPS tracker magnetically placed on a vehicle that travels on public roads was permissible and not a search.
But counsel, I guess that's, we're immersing ourselves in more technology than I really want to, but when a police officer is told by his supervisors and by lawyers that you can't hardwire a GPS to a car, that's an unreasonable search, right? And then they say, well, yeah, but if you just put it in a magnet box with strong batteries, you should be okay. My question is, how does that become a good faith exception to the requirement that you have a warrant before you track somebody across three states?
Well, I think there's two ways. I think there are two ways that the state of Ohio prevails in this case. The first is under United States v. Davis, Justice Alito was very clear, and twice he said the question before the court was whether binding appellate precedent would support the good faith exception. Justice Sotomayor clearly points out, though, that the question not before the court was whether non-binding precedent could also support the good faith exception. So what's
And that's what we're here for today, are we not?
One of two reasons. This court could find that in following knowing not to hardwire, in following the Garcia case, in following the MacGyver case, and also state or U.S. v. Michael, which was out of the Fifth Circuit, in following those cases, Detective Hackney here acted under everything there was federally, which is that his actions had been approved by every court up until October 23rd of 2008 that he placed. And so if non-binding precedent was not answered by the Supreme Court of the United States, this court could say that since it was universally accepted that he could do that, that it would be the answer that was, or the question left unanswered, as Justice Sotomayor said, that Detective Hackney acted properly and the good faith exception would apply. The second way would be the strict reading of U.S. v. Davis, which appellant has said should be the only reading. Well, we disagree with that, but even under the binding appellant precedent standard of United States v. Davis, Detective Hackney here, our argument is, was still acting under binding appellant precedent. Now, that binding appellant precedent has been found by multiple U.S. Circuit courts of appeals, and it's been found to apply in two separate ways. The first way it's been found to apply by the First Circuit in State v. Sparks, and recently, about a month ago, by the Fourth Circuit in State v. or U.S. v. Stevens, I'm sorry, I keep saying state, U.S. v. Stevens, was that Knotts itself provides the binding appellant precedent that tracking a person's movement on public thoroughfares was permitted. And that really goes back to, if you look at cases like South Dakota versus Opperman out of the U.S. Supreme Court from 1976, they said in Fourth Amendment cases, it's the theory of the case, not the limited specific facts that we must look at. So the theory of those cases in state or United States v. Sparks in the First Circuit made this clear. The theory of Knotts was always that you could track someone's movement on public thoroughfares, and that was constitutional. And so those two courts have found that way. The secondary way to look at this was found by the Second Circuit in United States v. Aguiar. There, the court said not only did Knotts control whether you could track someone's movement on a public thoroughfare, but in Jones, the United States Supreme Court seemed to put in this trespass doctrine. Now, I think it's important to note that in Jones, when they do that, the statements in that case really say that they're almost reviving. That, yeah, it's been, I think Mr. Gallagher said it's from old English law, but it had been forgotten for about 50 years. And the critical part that Aguiar points out about how it was forgotten and how we know that is go back to 1984. Two different U.S. Supreme Court cases, U.S. v. Caro and Oliver v. United States. In both of those U.S. Supreme Court cases from 1984, the court had a de minimis treatment of trespass under the Fourth Amendment. They either found it to be of limited or no relevance to the case, or found that it would not be enough to find that someone's actions were unconstitutional. So you have the Knotts case and the theory of that saying it was perfectly permissible under the Constitution to track. Then you have in 1984, Caro and Oliver, where the U.S. Supreme Court has a de minimis treatment of a trespass doctrine and says it's of limited, if any, relevance, and it wouldn't be enough to reverse something under the Constitution. It's not until Jones revives this, and Jones discusses its revival of this trespass doctrine, that the officers would have had any way to know that. That's why you have the MacGyver case and the Garcia case saying this was fine. That's why this case was before this court the first time, where the whole panel of the 12th District said, this is fine under Knotts and under Caro. That is not only how a detective who didn't go to law school should have understood this. You know, as Judge Nastoff found in the motion to suppress hearing, you know, Judge Posner of the Seventh Circuit found this. I can't find that our detective should have been smarter than the Federal Circuit Court judge.
So you use the term legal landscape several times. Are you saying that really the legal landscape changed with Jones and the officer could not have anticipated that?
Correct. And in dealing with the federal constitution, I know the appellant has cited some state court cases out of New York, Washington, and Oregon. The important part of all three of those cases, they were all decided on that state's constitution. They didn't find it to be a violation of the U.S. Constitution. They found that their state constitution gave broader protections. And so those cases don't support the argument that any federal court, any court in Ohio, or any detective in Ohio should have been on notice of that. And I know we have amicus from different parts of the state, but I would also say specifically to Sudenia Johnson. In 1995, in State v. Payne, the 12th District also issued a decision saying that trespass had limited, if any, relevance to the Fourth Amendment as well. So not only do you have Carolyn Oliver as binding precedent, but on our officers, 11 years after those two cases, you still had that being echoed by the 12th District Court of Appeals.
Counsel, if your co-counsel is going to have any time.
Oh, I'm sorry, Your Honors. I thought the lights were going to work for that. I apologize.
No.
And I apologize to my co-counsel. Thank you, Your Honors.
Apologies all around.
Counsel, by my estimation, you have about 2 minutes.
Thank you. Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, I'd like to address a line of questions about whether, on the one hand, the technological differences between beeper technology and cell phone technology, and on the other hand, GPS technology, should make any difference in this case. As every federal circuit court of appeals that's addressed the question has held, it makes no difference. The answer to that is no. And here's why. Because in Davis versus United States, the U.S. Supreme Court applied a broader principle, and that's this: that the exclusionary rule applies only when it is necessary to deter police misconduct. And police misconduct is deliberate, reckless, or grossly negligent disregard for Fourth Amendment rights. Now, the officer's actions here can't be said to rise to that level of culpability. Consider what we've talked about as the legal landscape in October 2008. First, the U.S. Supreme Court, and this is at page 281 of Knotts, said that an individual in an automobile has no reasonable expectation of privacy in his movements on public roads, meaning the Fourth Amendment simply isn't implicated when you're in a car and we're tracking your movements. Second, the Sixth Circuit had held in Forrest that no warrant was required to track someone in an automobile using their cell phone.
Counsel, wait a minute, though. Aren't the courts unanimous that you can't hardwire a GPS to a car that's on the roads?
Well, that's not what happened here, Your Honor.
I understand that, but you say we have no expectation of privacy on a public road. Is that true?
It is true, Your Honor, because—
No expectation of privacy.
That's what Knotts held at page 281. Now, we know after Jones that that may no longer be true, but as things stood in October 2008, that was certainly what the officers would have understood. The issue of a hard wire or the issue of a mob tapping, FBI tapping a mobster's phone, is that that intrudes into the—
Well, they were putting recording devices surreptitiously inside the cars, and that's how they got them. But let me direct you to a different question. It's really not here, but remains troubling to me after Jones. Jones was decided on what to me was a bit of a quirky way to get there, using the trespass theory. Should we take another one of these cases? You know, we were about to announce our view on this subject when Jones came out, and so we didn't then. Should we take another one of these cases and decide it based on the Ohio Constitution so that there is more clarity than perhaps Jones gives, because of there are still some open questions, are there not, due to the way the U.S. Supreme Court came to it using the trespass theory?
My time is up. May I respond? Thank you. As far as I can tell from the cases in the lower courts, there hasn't been confusion about what the Ohio Constitution says in this area.
I think. No, I'm not asking that. I'm asking, is there Is there absolute clarity about what the U.S. Supreme Court said in Jones by virtue of the trespass theory, or are there still open questions about whether or not you can stick one of these devices on in certain circumstances without a warrant?
Here's what I understand the holding.
And if there is, then should we look at it under the Ohio Constitution and address those open questions? So we don't have this kind of case where you're then in arguing, well, it isn't what the Ohio Supreme Court ultimately decided was okay, but it was okay at the time.
As I understand, what Jones held was simply that attachment and monitoring of a GPS device is a search. It didn't hold that a warrant is required for that search, or probable cause without a warrant, or reasonable suspicion without a warrant. We briefed that a little bit on pages 11 and 19 of our brief. So there are some open questions after Jones. Now, as to the question whether the court should take a case, that goes back to my point that I don't believe that there's confusion below that what is required. I think generally the court doesn't take a case without some level of confusion or some controversial rulings below. So I don't think that issue is ripe.
And that brings me to my question. What is your analysis of how extensive this issue is in our state at the moment? Is this something that is so narrowly done that we will not experience it again? Or is there a whole breadth of cases coming on these topics?
So in terms of the issue before the court today, whether the good faith exception applies, I don't think there are all that many cases left simply because Jones was decided in January of 2012. Most of the pre-Jones search cases have already gone through by this point.
So it's a narrow application of whatever we decide today, in your view.
I think that's right. And I don't think the court needs today to speak on the underlying constitutional question or any matter beyond whether an officer who uses magnetized GPS attachment and monitoring before Jones acts in good faith reliance on pre-Jones precedent.
Well, that's maybe, you know, to the immediate response to Justice O'Donnell's question, but how we treat Davis, and that's what the bigger component I see of this case is, and not just as it relates to GPS magnetically attached to a car. I think it's our response to good faith, the good faith exception based on binding precedent, and then our treatment of what is binding precedent. So I think that this is a much bigger case than just limited to the application of a GPS system, because I agree with you. I would guarantee that every law enforcement officer now gets a warrant to put any kind of device on any vehicle. And that
the safe ones do, that's right.
Yes, so that's not really, this case has much bigger magnitude than that. So with that, I don't expect a response.
Okay.
Your time is up. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chief, before you let him go, I do have a question along those lines, since you are from the Attorney General's office. Isn't this case really about you're asking, or we're being asked today, to make a decision between the deliberate reckless standard versus the reasonable police officer standard based upon the legal landscape that he or she knows?
Two responses to that, Your Honor. First, the issue of what he or she knows, the U.S. Supreme Court has held that it's not a subjective inquiry. It's not about what this particular officer in fact knows. The standard they've used is what a reasonably well-trained officer would have known. It's an objective standard. So that's the first part of the response. The second response is it's not a choice between a reasonable officer standard and a deliberate, reckless, grossly negligent standard. We think those are just two sides of the same coin. A reasonable officer doesn't act deliberately, recklessly, or grossly negligently. And so if you find that the officer here acted reasonably, then we don't think the exclusionary rule applies. And of course, we think it only applies if the officer here acted deliberately, recklessly, or grossly negligently. With that, we'll ask that you affirm the judgment of the 12th District.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel, you've used your time, but you may take a minute to sum up.
The United States Supreme Court said the real question with the exclusionary rule is the deterrence of future Fourth Amendment violations. They don't require misconduct. They talk about basically deterrence and culpability. The culpability is whether or not the officer did some actions that resulted in the Fourth Amendment violation.
That's precisely it. There's no deterrent effect here because these cases are done, and Jones is pretty well clarified. Well, you've admitted that, and I think Mr.
I think the deterrence is there, which is as technology continues to change, you can't analogize to other cases. Davis tells you what you need to act on, which is binding precedent. We don't want officers basically trying to make analogies to decide whether they need a warrant. We want the default to be.
But doesn't Jones step in and preclude that judgment any further? Don't you think law enforcement has been made aware of the Jones decision?
Absolutely, but as technology changes, the next technology, an officer, if you decide to expand Davis, is going to say, well, I can make an analogy to another case, so therefore I won't see the judge to get a warrant this time because it seemed okay when something was close to this. And that's why I think Davis makes clear, which is unless you have really binding precedent, don't go there. See a judge and get a warrant.
Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen. We will take the matter under advisement. You'll be notified of our decision.